there, cuz. Welcome to the next episode of How Good It Is. And today, we have a truly overstuffed episode with one of the Yardbirds. How good it is. Hi there, I'm Claude Call. Jim McCarty is the original drummer for the Yardbirds, which, despite the fact that they're in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, doesn't often get mentioned as part of the pantheon of rock and roll these days. Instead, they seem to have the label of being the band that Eric Clapton, Jimmy Page, and Jeff Beck were in before they got big, which is silly because the Yardbirds were not only big, but they were influential back in the day. McCarty has written two books. The first is called Nobody Told Me, which is about his life with and after the Yardbirds. And now he's got a second book called She Walks in Beauty, My Quest for the Bigger Picture. The book starts almost exactly 2 years ago, the day his wife Lizzie died, and it works its way back and forth in time as he shares with us his lifelong pursuit of elements of the world which are just beyond our typical perception. And what has he discovered? Well, you're going to have to read the book, but he does talk about some of that here, as well as some of his insights into some of the Yardbirds' bigger hits. Incidentally, prior to the interview, I had sent him a note asking him if he'd heard a specific cover of the song For Your Love, because it's one of my favorite musical tracks, and I was so gratified to know that he did know it, and maybe a little bit more, which he talks about here. I did include a short clip of the recording here in the interview, but if you check out the website, I will link to the entire song. We communicated with each other through Zoom from opposite sides of the Atlantic Ocean, and while we had some technical issues at first, we managed to persevere and had a fantastic conversation despite the both of us suffering from allergies. For me, it was a lot of sniffling. For him, it was some throat clearing and coughing. But I think I managed to edit most of that out. So here's me with Jim McCarty. I actually have both of your books. I picked up Nobody Told Me first, and then my copy of the newer book, She Walks in Beauty, arrived the day after. And I said, you know what? I'm going to put Nobody Told Me away for the time being. And just... because I really do want to concentrate on the more recent book. And, you know, I mean, you've already done your press tour for Nobody Told Me.
Yeah.
That was like, you know, a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And I figured you've pretty much told whatever you're going to tell out of that anyway. And I, you know, give you an opportunity to talk about the new stuff. And I have to say, like, I was thinking about doing this interview, like, a couple of weeks ago, like right after Anne first contacted me, and I got through like the first, like the introduction and the first chapter, and I was like, oh, this is the date we have to talk. And no. I will tell you why, because I saw specifically early in the book, the date that your wife had died. Okay. June 7th, 2020. And I'm so sorry to hear about that.
Yes.
But there's, by a very strange coincidence, my mom died on June 8th, not the same year, but it was a few years earlier. And it was like one of those things where I took as a sign, like, okay, mom's talking to me here. And basically, this is some of the thrust of what you're writing about is that once in a while, the people we have lost are... they do try to contact us. They do try to send us messages. And you were talking specifically about, you know, birds and so forth and a little smudge in a photograph that you had taken and things like that. Yeah. And I've had plenty of times where I see something and I say, gee, that's a little weird. That's kind of a coincidence. And then I check the date and it is somehow I can tie it to my mother. And I do have to wonder, is this my mom sending me a message of some kind? And
yes.
So I wonder, like, I know that you have a long history of looking into things of the paranormal and you know, the whole life after death thing, which, you know, some people kind of smirk at. I get it. But how did you come around to this specific viewpoint?
Well, I've been interested for years and years, going back to my childhood, really, in all that stuff. But the difference is now I'm suddenly faced with it. It's sort of become my reality. Mm-hmm. I'm sort of stepped into the bubble, if you like. Whereas before I was outside looking in, now I'm in there. now I'm in there and it's part of my life, you know? and it's become really a journey of consciousness for me to find out all these things firsthand, and you know, suddenly all these things are happening to me, and I'm actually faced with it all and getting ways of getting through it and ways of understanding it. And I mean, I understand it a lot more than I did, but it's still nothing to what the real total understanding must be, you know. So I'm still moving forward with it slowly. I have to thank my wife for helping me through and giving me all these signs and communicating and sort of pointing me in the right direction or whatever she's doing. Because it's been such a wonderful journey, even though I've been grieving at the same time.
And what for you is the difference between this is probably a coincidence and this is a sign from Lizzie, and I'm going to even throw in one more, is like, this is a sign, this is a message from Lizzie.
Yes, it's a very fine line. It's a very fine line. I suppose it's really within us or within me to recognize it, and it's just a feeling. Oh, that's definitely her. Now and then it's a bit vague as to whether it's just a coincidence. But things, you know, I've opened my mind and I've been alert to all these things happening, because you don't normally notice things. You know, I was boiling an egg one day, and it was coming up to 9 o'clock in the morning, and you know, I started it about 9:02, and then all of a sudden the timer on the oven suddenly went to 2100, which has never happened before. Hang on here, what's going on? And usually there are things like that that are very funny, and they make you laugh, and the light's flashing, you know, when you have a certain thought. And it's quite funny. It's sort of really larger than life in a way.
Mm-hmm. And then tell me about the story. Tell me the story of the photograph. That was kind of interesting to me. Did you know when you first took the photograph that you were kind of replicating a photograph that you had taken earlier of Lizzie?
Yes, I did. I had some very nice friends with me, and I had that photo of Lizzie on that bridge, and then we weren't looking for anything. We just thought it'd be nice to have a picture on the same bridge, and so we all stood there having that picture. My friend's wife took the picture on an actual camera, and we had no idea that something was going to appear like that. And she sent me the photo, and I thought, what's that in the middle, that great big round blob, you know? And it was so interesting. And apparently this does happen. You do get, they're called orbs, and they happen. And I've seen, you know, videos of them from other people. Sometimes they move around, they shoot around the room, and I've seen instances of other orbs, so from others. So, but I didn't know at the time. It was just very strange.
And you said it appeared brown in the photo.
It was. I don't know what color it was. It was like a. It was sort of a bluey color, wasn't it? I think.
In the book, it's a black and white photo. So
yeah, it's black and white. It was sort of a bluey mauve color in the actual photo, and it was exactly where she was standing in the photo before.
Yes, I did see that, and it was that's kind of interesting to me, though, because a lot of times when you see people representing stuff like this, and you know, oh, here's the mysterious, you know, thing in the picture, you know, more often than not, it comes off as like a kind of grayish white. And for it to be a color,
yeah, you know,
that strikes me as a little bit different.
Yes, yes. And she communicates in colors, particularly a mauve color. Sometimes I'm just sort of meditating and thinking about her, and I would get my mind flooded with a sort of a mauve-y color, which is a very spiritual color, apparently.
Really? I did not know that.
Yeah. It's a very high, it's from the highest chakra in your body, the crown chakra, associated with that.
So at the risk of repeating myself, the title of the book is She Walks in Beauty, My Quest for the Bigger Picture. And while there is a lot here about the spiritual journey that you've taken over the years, since all the way back to when you were in the Yardbirds, there are some stories about your career as well. And so, yes. You know, I don't want, you know, people to think that, well, this is all the book is about and just, you know, dismiss it out of hand. There's still, you know, a lot of good stories about your career with the Yardbirds and since then. And it's kind of funny because I reached out to a couple of people and I said, you know, do you have any questions like you might not have heard previously that I could ask? And, you know, the first person goes like straight to Jimmy Page. And I'm like, really? He's like, okay. I was like, he's got to be tired of the Jimmy Page and the Eric Clapton questions. Like, what else you got me? But it does occur to me that changes like that to a band, I mean, these are not huge names yet, you know, but yes. It's still got to affect the dynamic of the group when you lose a player, like when Eric Clapton leaves the band or when Jimmy Page leaves and that kind of thing. That's really got to spin the dynamics a little bit, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah, yes. And we were very lucky because we had the, you know, waiting in the wings, if you want to say that. We were lucky. We always fell on our feet with someone else that was equally good. But it was difficult. Well, with both Eric and Jeff, you know, they were basically quite unhappy in the group and they didn't really want to work as a team. And we were always a team when we started. I always considered it as a team. We all put in our little bits and we all, you know, move forward together. But they didn't want to do that. And I can understand, you know, they're solo guys. They want to run the show. They want to call the shots. And they were very unhappy going along with other guys like us in the end. Mm-hmm. But we were lucky to have these great players. But yes, the dynamic changed and the sound changed, only subtly, really, between each of them. But I would say that Jeff Beck gave the group the sound that everyone remembers. And he played on the big songs, you know, all the, you know, Heart Full of Soul, Shapes of Things, and Over Under, Sideways Down, all the songs that people remember.
Mm-hmm. You guys, like so many of the British bands, you started out as like with kind of a bluesy sound, like, you know, like the Stones would do the same thing. Like they were considered a blues band. You guys were a blues band early on. And so I kind of understand the broader story of like, you know, where Clapton's like, you know, he hears, you know, the For Your Love and then just kind of loses it and say, hey, I thought we were going to do this other thing and I'm out, you know? But it seems to me that there was still like a pretty strong blues component to the other music that you guys were doing. And so it feels like there should be just a little bit more to the story than that.
Yeah, well, we tried to do a bluesy singles. The name of the game in those days was your hit single, and every band needed a hit single to progress, to be, you know, to be noticed. And we were slightly behind because all our contemporaries had all had hit singles, and we tried bluesy things, and they didn't work for us. You know, I Wish You Would was a single, Good Morning Little Schoolgirl. You know, they were good songs, but they weren't going to really get up there in the top 10.
Yeah,
that's what we needed.
So why was the blues just so hot at that time in the UK?
Well, it suddenly appeared about 1962, 63. Suddenly we started to hear, Muddy Waters and Howling Wolf, Chuck Berry, Slim Harpo. All those guys came at once. And I think it was the Stones that first picked it up in a big way. I first went to see the Stones with Paul Samuel Smith, our bass player. Must have been about 1962, and they had another drummer. They didn't have Charlie, and they were playing the stuff. And I thought, I've never heard music like this. I've heard rock and roll, all the Everly Brothers and Buddy Holly and all that, but it's not really the same. It's like it's got something different about it. Mm-hmm. And I thought, this is great. And it made a big impact. And then I found out where it had come from. And a lot of these records started to circulate in London, sort of on an underground level. And, a lot of people started to play them. You know, Zaz of the Pretty Things and the Kinks, the Stones, of course, and Animals, all these other bands, they picked up these songs on their repertoire. But really, it was all out of not many albums, probably about 10 albums comprising all these different blues artists that we got our repertoire from. And we tried to avoid doing the same songs the Stones did. So we did different versions of, we do another song by Chuck Berry and we do a different song by Howling Wolf, and make sure we didn't copy any of their covers.
And yeah, it just seems like you guys just also, as a genre, really, not specifically Yardbirds, but like a lot of these bands, you just kind of added a little bit of extra power, like electricity, to the basic sound.
Yes, and then we sort of did that for a while, and then we wanted to spread out a bit. And we thought, let's make these songs a bit different, and change the rhythms within the song, and do a bit of improvisation, and put some sounds in. And of course, Jeff had all these sounds, mm-hmm. And he could play all these, weird and wonderful sounds. He loved all that. And it went with the way we wanted to go. It was something, we want to do this sort of music, but make it different, make it our own, if you like.
Let's talk about For Your Love. That was probably your first big one, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Now, let me ask you this, because was that a genuine harpsichord that you guys were using, or was it some other kind of studio trick?
Oh, no. No, they didn't have tricks in those days. it's all tricks now, isn't it? No, it was a harpsichord. It was Paul Samuel Smith's idea, mm-hmm. because we'd heard the Graham Gouldman demo, the little version he'd done himself. And it had a 12-string guitar, I think, and bongos. I don't know if it had that. It might have had the time change in the middle, I can't remember, but we were sort of quite faithful to that. But instead of the 12 string, we used the harpsichord, and then a bowed bass playing the like a string line.
Now, how'd you get a hold of the song?
Well, it was brought to our manager by a publisher from Feldman's that became like EMI Music eventually. And he'd seen us playing with the Beatles at their Christmas show in Hammersmith in 1964. And we were on the bill, and he saw us, and he had this demo disc and sent it round to our manager, Giorgio Gomelski. And we went to his apartment and had a listen to it. And we thought, oh, this is interesting. This is maybe not a blues song, but it's the sort of song that would be a hit. And it's moody, and it's a, you know, it's a good song. It's unusual, and it would suit us. So we all went with it. Apart from Eric, who he did play on it, but he didn't really like it. So there you go.
And you know, it's, this is kind of silly, but one of the things that attracts me to the song is this is one of those things that I guess, you know, it either speaks to you or it doesn't. But one of the things I really like about it is in the lyrics, where you kind of break a line into two, you know, so it's like he starts a sentence in one line and then continues it in the next. And I don't know.
Yeah.
I just kind of like stuff like that.
It's a clever song. It's unusual, and it's very moody, you know, it's in a minor key. And of course that version that I'd heard that you mentioned, Krishna Das, I've heard that already, and it's wonderful. It's a wonderful version of it, you know. It makes it even more moody.
Yeah, well, the story behind that supposedly is that he was fooling around with the chanting thing, and he kind of realized that he was using a lot of the same chords. So he just started goofing around and started singing For Your Love and said, oh, this actually works here, you know?
Yes, it fitted perfectly the way they did it. And it was interesting how it suddenly appeared. And of course it was used, you know, used in a different way. For Your Love was to his master, or you know, his god, and it was a lovely chant, devotional chant.
So let me ask you this, and I'm sure this is one of those questions you get asked a million times, but first, I'm sure that, you know, people hammer you all the time with, hey, have you heard this cover of your song? And do you have a favorite cover of well, we'll start with For Your Love, and then of a Yardbird song.
Let me see. I'd say that was the best cover, for my money. That Krishna Das one. But if you could call it a cover, but I'd say that was a very, very good version of that song. There's other people that did it, but not so different to ours.
And then what about, like, just in general, other Yardbird songs? What would be one of your favorites?
Well, Shapes of Things has been done quite a bit. Jeff Healy did a good version. David Bowie did a nice version. Within my lonely frame, my eyes just hurt my brain, but will it seem the same? And of course the latest one is Deep Purple. Deep Purple do a very good version, actually. Very days. And fantastic guitar. Really, really well done. It's actually really good.
I wanted to talk a little bit about Heart Full of Soul, which is probably one of my favorites of the Yardbirds. And I really love the deep echoes, especially in the background singing. And you know, it's got this really cool sound to it. And is there a cool story behind that one? I hope.
Oh, yes, there is. Yes, there is. We were booked to go in the studio to do it. We'd heard the demo. It was another Graham Gouman song. So we'd heard the version by him, and it was very similar. It had bongos on and the 12 strings stuff. And we went in the studio for the session one evening, and we looked in the we looked in the vocal booth, and there was a guy playing sitar with another guy playing tablas. And Giorgio, our manager, thought, "Oh, this would suit the song." So we'd try the sitar playing the opening riff, you know, da da na 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 na, and it actually sounded quite nice. But it was a bit weak compared to what we needed. As you said before, we had a very electric, very sort of energetic sound, particularly with Jeff. And it just didn't really happen at the beginning with the sitar. Although it was a nice, and the version is there somewhere, it came out. But Jeff said, "Oh, I can play this very easy. I have the fuzz box," and he played it in 5 minutes, and that really worked. And so we never really used the sitar version, except later on it came out as a sort of special, you know, collector's version, really.
My understanding is that there was a review at the time that described it as like having an oriental touch, which,
yes,
I don't think I quite get. I understand like the feeling of raga rock, but oriental touch seems a little bit unusual. But it sounds like you would agree with his that review.
Yes, I would. Yeah, it was it sort of worked for a sitar. It did work, but the sound didn't really work. It wasn't a really our sound. Mm-hmm. But Ravi Shankar and all that stuff became very popular in those days, and we loved all that stuff as well, you know, loved the Indian music, and I still do. I still love it. It was something that was going around on a sort of underground thing in the 60s anyway, and it sort of fitted our style, you know, and I thought it worked very well.
There are a couple of live albums that you folks did, and it seems like maybe more than a typical band would release. I'm kind of wondering about the thinking behind that. And then also your second American album was called Having a Rave Up with the Yardbirds.
Yes.
Where one side was studio recordings and the other side was live recordings.
Okay.
And I'm kind of wondering about the decisions that went into that. I think it's really cool. Like your live performances are neat, especially since you do have this habit of, or you know, of you start with the basic song and then you just kind of go into this extended riffing before you come back around to it. And I think that's really neat. It's you at the same time, you're not necessarily, you know, killing time the way some jam bands would.
No, we like to improvise, and we had that jazzy jazz thing going as well. especially things like Smokestack Lightning, which was all in one key of the whole song. So we needed to take it around in different places. And it was nice working off each other. And sometimes in a live show, that would work really well. It would all come together and we'd be playing as a unit really, really great, you know, and other times didn't work. But, yeah, I mean, our live sound was always always very strong, and that's why we recorded our first album live at the Marquee, because that worked a lot better, because the sound in the studios in England wasn't so bright, wasn't so good at the time. It was difficult to get a real punchy sound. We found it improved, through the end of the 60s. It got a lot better, mm-hmm. and it was better in America. You know, a lot of our recordings we did there. You know, we recorded in Chess Studios in Chicago. We did Shapes of Things there, and we did some other stuff down in Sun in Memphis, and we got a much better sound. At the time, because the American engineers were superior.
Yeah, I was just about to ask about that. Do you're finding a difference between, you know, studios in one place versus studios in another? Does it boil down to just the engineer, or is there something about the space, or is it just, you know, because you're in, here I am in Chicago and I've got like Chicago energy going on, or is there something else attached to that?
Well, it's a combination, you know. You're going in Chess Studios, you think, oh, all these fantastic blues records were made here. Or the same with Sun, and you would be excited. So that was all part of it. But it was like geared for a good sound, and the engineers knew what they were doing. And I remember going into Chess and recording Shapes of Things, and I said, okay, well, where's the drum kit? I need to have a go at the drum kit. I said, oh, it's over there. And it was a sort of beaten up old kit. It had all this, I had a bag of cement in the bass drum. And I thought, oh my God, well, this drum kit's terrible. How on earth they get a good sound? But they did. And they had it all worked out. This was the sound that they used for the drum kit they used for all the great blues records, so it sounded great, and they knew what they were doing. They've been doing it for a long time, and then in Sun, you know, we were working with Sam Phillips, and he recorded Elvis and Howling Wolf and all that stuff, so he really knew what he was doing.
Yeah, well, it's not like the guys at EMI were any slackers, though. I mean, so.
I know, but they were all slightly behind at the time. I don't know. They got better, but they learned a lot from the American engineers, I'm sure.
Yeah, I think from the stories that I've read, it seems like, you know, the folks, at least at EMI, were maybe a little bit behind the times to a certain extent, in the sense that they were kind of late to adopt some of the techniques and even some of the equipment, which is with, like, you know, it taking forever for the Beatles to get like up to four tracks when they record, and, you know, and things like that. Yeah. And there are stories about them like sneaking into closets and stealing equipment so that they could try it out, and you know, the engineers having a fit later on.
I'm sure. And funnily enough, the studios in Germany and the Scandinavia, so, and some of the live stuff we did there was really good. It was superior to the English sound. I mean, we didn't record any studio stuff, but the live recordings that come out of some of those German TV shows, they really still sound great. So I don't know what was going on in England. They were slightly behind, especially in the BBC as well, because we go in the BBC and they tell us to turn down the guitar, you know, and when you turn the guitar down, you just don't get that sound. The sound, it just sounds weedy. There's no power in it. And it was almost like they were like the men in white coats, you know, in the science fiction. And of course, we'd record the songs at the BBC and they say, oh, don't worry about if you make a mistake, because they'll only play it once. They'll never hear it again. And then it comes out 50 years later, you know, the best of the Yardbirds on BBC.
Well, yeah, I was listening to, what was that long ago? Just maybe a couple of weeks. It was a Jimi Hendrix BBC session. And I thought it sounded really good, actually. I was like kind of surprised that, you know, this is something that they're recording for a radio broadcast. And I was like, maybe because I was listening to it through my car radio, that was like, okay, it's the same technology almost. And, you know, maybe that's what made it sound good. And I think that's maybe part of the calculus that goes into when BBC makes a recording. I'm thinking about the folks at Motown who would engineer records specifically to sound good on car radios and cheap transistor radios. And what they would do is they would make a test pressing and then they would play it on the crummiest record player they could find to simulate what it would sound like on a car radio. And if it sounded good that way, then they released it.
That's right. They had that all worked out, but playing on little speakers.
Yeah.
But of course, by the time Jimi Hendrix came along, I think that was like late 60s, wasn't it?
Yeah.
68, 69 or something. That BBC had improved. And some of the sessions got a much better sound.
Yeah. All right. Let me come back to having a rave up, because as I said, it was like that two-sided thing. Studios on one side, live on the other. And I'm kind of wondering about the decision that went into something like that. And well, I'll save the next question for after.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we had no control over what, because we were signed up, you know, to Epic.
Mm-hmm.
We actually signed to EMI, but all our EMI recordings went through Epic, which was part of CBS.
Right.
And they more or less did what they like. They didn't ask us, oh, is this what the band want? They just, we had no control over what they put out. And a lot of those early albums were compilations of singles and recordings from studios and live songs, as you say, and that was nothing to do with us. That was just the way they wanted to market the band.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing that kind of amused me was the liner notes on this album. And I'm sorry, my camera's not working, because you can see I have it in my hand here. This is actually a demo copy that I managed to get my hands on only this week. But there are liner notes written by somebody named Connie Deneve, and my understanding is that she is a PR person.
Yeah,
I don't know if she's
doing that.
And one of the things it says, well, when you hear the Yardbirds kind of rave up, you'll hear some basic rock and roll and some real old-fashioned blues. That makes sense. You'll hear simple, straightforward country music played with big band drive. And I was like, I'm not necessarily getting a country feel out of this. Did you listen to this album, lady?
I know she was pretty famous. She was the Epic's PR woman.
Yeah.
And I remember when we first went to America, probably late 65, I might be wrong, I think it was late 65, I think she came to meet us when we went in the hotel, we checked in. She came to meet us and she was, you know, making funny remarks like, you'll have to put makeup on those spots. You know, sort of old fashioned stuff. Oh, you'll have to cover up your spots for the television and things like that. And you can't be seen smoking on photos and all that. They don't want you to do that. And it was very sort of like something out of the 50s.
All right. And one of the other tracks on this album, it's the end of side one, is Train Kept a Rollin', which feels to me like you guys basically set the blueprint for every recording of Train Kept a Rolling that followed. I mean, this is not your song. You know, this, it's, it's, I I think it's traditional practically, isn't it? It was like just something that was found in manuscript and somebody set it to music. I think it's like maybe even public domain.
No. It was an old blues singer called Tiny Bradshaw.
Oh.
And his version is totally different. It's just a 12-bar swing, like a shuffle. You know, the train get the rolling all night long. And it was the version that we did. We based it on the I'm trying to think what the band was called now. It was I'll think of it in a minute. But it's the famous the Burnett Brothers. That's it. Sorry.
Oh,
yeah. The mind's woken up. the Burnett Brothers. They did the version with the riff, you know. And Jeff Beck had that version, and he said, "Oh, I love this song. We should do this." And then we took it on a bit more from their version. That was already there.
Yeah.
But I always thought it was a great guitar riff, you know.
Yeah. Well, there's a story about the song "Louie Louie" that after the instrumental, the singer comes in too early. He starts to sing the next verse, and he realizes he's come in too early. And the drummer covers with a fill, and then he sings.
All right.
But the thing is, that's become the template for singing "Louie Louie" now.
Yeah.
You stop, and then you sing again, right? And it feels like the same thing. It's like everybody does the Yardbirds version of "Train Kept a Rolling" nowadays.
Yes. I don't know who else did it apart from Aerosmith. There were other people, Chesterfield Kings or someone. Oh no, they did another one. I can't remember who else did the "Train Kept a Rolling." Apart from Aerosmith.
But there must that's probably be the most famous version.
Yeah, there must be other version, not so well known.
I know Led Zeppelin did it, actually.
Yeah, they would have done it because they did.
It was probably a carryover from Jimmy Page.
Well, they were doing some of our dates when they started. I think they were going as the new Yardbirds. Mm-hmm. And there were dates that we couldn't fulfill, so they played all our songs.
Yeah, and Johnny Burnett,
there you go.
But again, everybody's coming back to you guys on that, so it was just
kind of
cool and interesting. And Paul Samwell Smith is listed as the musical director on this particular album. I think he's on other tracks too, on other albums as well, with that specific title. What does a musical director do that, say, a producer does not?
Well, it was, yes, I suppose it was, a bit tricky to say I'm the producer. I mean, he became a great producer for Cat Stevens and other people, but it was probably one step up that ladder. You know, I'm the musical director. It's only because he had a few ideas of how it should sound. He was always into the sound of the band, and he was very good at hearing how we should sound, and he had good ideas. A lot of them went into For Your Love, for instance. But I think Giorgio Gomelski probably called himself the producer because he paid for the sessions.
Right. So I guess that sounds like then there would be more of a like a collaborative kind of role with the producer and or the engineer.
Yeah, the one album which was called The Yardbirds became known as Roger the Engineer.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the tracks Paul didn't play bass. He was just in the control room, and we had a bass player playing with us. Just a few of the tracks. Not the tracks we played live. Paul played on those, but I think about three or four tracks. Paul didn't play.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about Renaissance. This is interesting to me, if only because I was like going through the used record stores, you know, just see if I could beef up my catalog and just get back into not just the hits but some of the other stuff. And I found that first Yardbirds albums are kind of hard to find, and I did say something to one of the owners, the store owner. He's like, "Yeah, they're still popular." I was like, well, that's, you know, good for him. I mean, you know, unfortunately, he's not making any money off the resales in the record stores. But
where was this store?
There were a couple of stores. I tried a couple in Baltimore, where I live, and I found a couple of albums that actually originated in Europe. So one is from Germany, and the other is from Switzerland.
Right, yeah.
And Rave Up I found here in Baltimore, and then I found Box of Frogs. I was in Myrtle Beach for a weekend a couple weeks ago, and there was a record store I hadn't been in. And one of the things I'm learning is, as you go from city to city, you know, basically what people were buying at any given time is going to change from location to location. So what you're going to find in the used record stores is going to also take a different tenor. And yeah, so you know, I was, so it's when I'm in South Carolina, for instance, it's easier for me to find like old shag records and that sort of thing.
Yes, you
know? And but Yardbirds are still very popular. Box of Frogs is tough to find. I couldn't find any Jim McCarty era Renaissance. There were plenty of Renaissance albums to be found, but none had you as a performer on it. So I'd like to like hear the story behind your participation with that band.
Well, we formed the band. we started it. I mean, it was started by me and Keith Ralph, the singer, and we'd come to the end of the Yardbirds. We'd really had enough of playing that stuff at the time, and we were very tired, and we'd been on the road for a long time, and we just wanted to do something fresh. And we'd written some songs, and we wanted to make the best out of them. So, cut a long story short, we formed another band, and it was quite different. It had the keyboards in, John Hawkin on piano and keyboards, who was actually in a good rock band, the Nashville Teens. They were quite big in England. He just had the idea, he'd play a bit of classical here and there. Because he was classically taught, and it really worked, and it worked because he could play rock and roll as well. So we did both, but the classical sound was something that we took up in the band. It became like an experiment, it was like everything else, you know. It was an accident at first, but it worked, and we kept going with it, and it created that sound. And finally, we just did the two albums and went back on the road and thought, oh no, we're back where we were, really. We were just on the road again, you know, just playing and playing. And we sort of left, and a new band took over. So probably all the stuff you saw was the new group.
Yeah. Now, was there any overlap between the two, or was it just, you know, somebody else just kind of picked up where you left off?
Well, slowly one person changed and one dropped out. And I think John Hawkin was the last one to be in the band. And he brought in Mickey Dunford, who was in the new band, who played in the Nashville Teens with him earlier. And he turned out to be a pretty good songwriter. And also, you know, he wrote songs with Betty Thatcher that I'd written with before. She was a poet from Cornwall, and I started to write songs of her poetry. It was a sort of project. And then I lost touch with the band. I was writing songs for the new band too, and I lost touch with them. Mm-hmm. And Mickey Dunford took over as the songwriter, and they did some great songs, you know, things like Ashes Are Burning. You know, it's a really good song.
Yeah, yeah. I guess this might be kind of akin to the asking about covers, but I got to wonder, is it a little bit weird when you see the band that you form, like, still out there and doing stuff, and, you know, and you're not necessarily part of it? Does that feel strange at all when you're like in the moment, like during the 70s and 80s?
Well, it can be a bit weird, but I thought it was very honourable because I got asked to play at their 50th anniversary show, which was about 3 years ago, and I went to the Keswick in Philadelphia and played a couple of shows as well beforehand, and played acoustic guitar. You know, it was good. It was fun. And they're a great band because they had the whole orchestra playing with them too. And Annie had been in the band since we split, really, 1972, I think she joined, and she'd been in the band all that time, and all the musicians had changed. But it was a great show, and they had a great band. They were lovely people, and I was very honoured to be asked to play it, and I enjoyed it.
Yeah, she's got a fabulous voice. I love her
song. Yeah.
And then what about Box of Frogs? You said in your book that, like, well, they just never really took off. I really enjoyed their sound, frankly. It was a little bit retro, but maybe that's what the appeal was for me. But when you say it didn't really take off, was that as far as, like, well, it didn't sell, so we bailed out? Or was it more along the lines of, you know, we've kind of done what we're going to do here and let's move on?
Well, it wasn't a totally committed. I'd say everyone involved, they weren't totally committed to it. You know, some of the guys were doing other things. It was basically a Yardbirds reunion.
That's the way it was framed, yeah.
So we got some of us got back together, Paul and Chris and myself, and started to write new songs. We always enjoyed seeing each other anyway, and we were talking about, you know, we always had that sort of common ground, you know, like a family. And we started to write more and more songs, and it suddenly got bigger and bigger, and became a project. And then we started to record an album, and we asked Jeff Beck in, and other people we knew, you know, Steve Hackett and other Rory Gallagher and all those people, and it became good fun. And I think the only problem was that we never toured, we never played a live gig. It was just recording. If we'd have gone and toured America a couple of times, it probably would have taken off. But that was it, and you couldn't really go any further with it once we'd finished.
Yeah, I think there's also even that was the first album was 1984, right? So I think there might have still also been a mentality of, like, if a band is either together or they're not.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And you couldn't necessarily just, like, split off and do a solo album, do your own project, and then come back to the band, which, you know, kind of happened to the Beatles. It kind of happened to Kiss. It kind of happened to, there were several bands where you could say that kind of thing. Like, this guy was just itching to do a different project, and so the band had to break up, you know, as opposed to, well, let him go do the different project and come back. And it was really around that time. That's when Mick Jagger did a solo album. It was around that same time. But Rolling Stones are still a thing, you know?
I remember. Yes, it didn't work. And, you know, they, as I said, the commitment wasn't there with the band to make it any bigger. But it was fun while it lasted. We did some good songs. Actually, we still play, because I still play in the Yardbirds. We're coming over in September. We're playing some dates on the East Coast. We still play Back Where I Started, which was one of the big Box of Frog songs, and I sing actually. I sing it.
Do you? Okay. Tell me about Stairway. That was an interesting story.
Yeah, that was something that just arrived. I mean, I went through a time when it was difficult to get any of my material heard. It was like you had to get a, you know, record deal. You know, it was. To get it out there, and I had various ideas for things, and I was spending quite a bit of time with Louis Sonamo, that was the bass player in in Renaissance, and we always got on very well. We were quite spiritually orientated, and we used to listen to meditation sort of music music from a genre of, well, shall we say, New Age, but anything to do with, you know, massage or meditation or relaxation. And we had ideas, and it was just a fun thing, because I went on to playing keyboards, and Louis was a bass player, and he was playing acoustic guitar, so we weren't on our real instrument. So it was just fun. It was like almost like an amateur project, but there was quite a market for that sort of music in England. A lot of shops that sold that sort of music with everything else, like the candles and the incense and the you know, the Buddhist books and all that. So mm-hmm. So we actually what we did quite well, and we, you know, I think one of our records sold like 100,000 or something crazy, you know.
And that was on cassette besides.
Yeah, we started on cassette, and then they went up to CD.
Interesting. Like around that period, I was working in a record store, and this was as the CDs were starting to take over the world. And the store that I worked in, we sold a lot of New Age, but it was almost entirely the Windham Hill label. And so,
yes,
you know, they were like really dominant at that time. So New World, nope, hadn't heard of it. It was like a lot of these other, and there's a bunch of New Age labels, but Windham Hill was like just everything to, it seemed like, to the industry. Like if you wanted a New Age, you went to Windham Hill. Well, it didn't feel like it, like there were any other labels. And, you know, looking back, I see, geez, there were a bunch of them. But I think part of it was also just like, maybe they had the PR, maybe they had something else. Maybe it was just a word of mouth, and just everybody in the neighborhood where my store was located, you know, thought, I want a Windham Hill CD. And
yeah, they did it very well, didn't they? They had that piano player that sold a lot of records at Windham Hill, didn't they? Can't remember his name. I can't remember, but funny enough, a couple of months ago I heard this great track,
George Winston.
That's it, George Winston. But I heard this track a couple of months ago. It just came up because I was doing all this medium stuff. You know, I was studying, doing a medium course with Suzanne Giesman, who's a teacher, a very good teacher of mediums, a very, very well set up person. And I just heard this music, and I thought, oh, this is wonderful. I have to get this. And it was on the Hearts of Space label. Do you remember that?
I do, actually, yes.
I thought, I'm never going to get a hold of this. How will I get it? It was by somebody called Raphael.
Dude, they had a radio program too, didn't they? It was like a syndicated show.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, Hearts of Space. It was it came out of San Francisco, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to get it. Of course, I'm very determined with these sort of things, and I managed to get the CD on Amazon.com. I was very pleased. So I can play it now. Very good. It's a very good. He's a very good piano, you know, new age pianist, let's say.
I would love to hear some of that material, because I just to get into something a little bit, something that isn't Windham Hill.
So. Yes, we were on the smaller, I think it was called New World. First of all, it was New World Cassettes,
yeah.
And then it changed to New World Music. I mean, it was just like a little company, you know, with an office in someone's back room. It was just like it's very, very, very nicely done when it started.
Yeah. Now I have to wonder if there wasn't a little bit of confusion, because also at that time you had the genre of world music becoming a thing.
Oh, yes. 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 And all the Peter Gabriel stuff.
Right. Right.
Yeah. WOMAD and all those festivals. Yeah. Yeah, that was something that was, it was sort of similar, but not quite the same.
All right. Now, you mentioned a few minutes ago about like going to a medium course, but as far as I know, you don't consider yourself a medium, do you?
No. No, that brings up a funny story. Because on the course, you had to practice with people. And I didn't do it for that purpose. I just did it so I could communicate with my wife. And it gave me more and more clarity, and it worked. But they said, oh, you know, for your homework, you should practice being a medium. So I practiced with a couple of friends, and actually I did quite well. and somebody said, well, why don't you have a radio show where, you know, rock star Jim McCarty takes your, you know, connects with your relatives. Nobody's done it before. But I'd never do that.
So the Yardbirds are in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, right?
Yes.
So were you at the ceremony?
Yes. Yes, that was in 92.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that was great.
Tell me a little bit of that. Did you get to, like, see the museum itself and all, or was that open yet? Or
they didn't do it. Yeah, I don't think it was open then. Mm-hmm. They didn't do it in the museum. They did it in New York, in the Waldorf Astoria.
Okay.
The special evening celebration. I don't think the Cleveland Museum was finished then. Do they do it in Cleveland now? I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's in Cleveland.
Oh, they do it there. Yeah. But I have been to the museum and gave a few things to them. And we actually did, I think, it must be a good 10 years ago, we went and played there and did a Q&A with the audience. And it was nice. And they treated us really well. And it was nicely set up. It was well done.
Now, you still do tour, as far as I know. Well, you said you were doing something this fall.
And we have a very good band. I mean, they're all American apart from me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the only British Invasion person left. but they're all very good. They're all very good players. And bass player Kenny Aronson, played with a whole load of bands, you know, top bands in his time. He's a very experienced guy, and he's a great Yardbirds fan.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Godfrey Townsend. And then there's John Iden, who's the singer, and he was the singer on the Birdland album, which was right back in 2003, I think that came out.
Do you have specific dates or locations at this point yet, or it's still taking shape?
Yeah. I think we're playing something called the Big E Festival, which is in the Massachusetts, Springfield, in Massachusetts. We're playing there for two days or two nights or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
That's our key date, and then we're playing some clubs like Daryl's House and the Philadelphia Winery. Things like that we're playing. Not a huge tour, but we haven't actually played because of the pandemic. You know, sure. A lot of these dates got put off, so but we're just finally going to do them. So it's been a couple of years.
Well, this is cool. Philadelphia is not a long drive from Baltimore, so I would make a point of coming to that show.
Oh, no, we're playing at Annapolis.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, we're playing down there. What's that club called?
Ramshead, maybe?
Ramshead, exactly. Yeah, we're playing there.
That's a fun venue. Okay, Ramshead. I'm writing that. I'm literally writing that down as we speak, so I can...
Yeah, I can't tell you the date. I think it's sort of late September, sort of 21st September, something like that. But it's all written on our website.
Let me ask you this. Do you have any broader causes that are, like, are pet projects for you?
Not particularly, but my wife actually had a sarcoma, which is a very aggressive form of cancer,
mm-hmm.
which spread you know, it was a sort of a little lump in her arm that spread all around. And the US Sarcoma Foundation was very helpful. They suggested some good things. And if I was going to be involved in a charity, it would be them. I'm interested in things, you know, helping people. And I certainly hope it helps people that are grieving and gives them some understanding about what happens when we pass over, that we don't really die. We're still around.
Yeah, I think it's been like 9 years today, as I said earlier, for my mom. And I think it gave me like a little bit of clarity and just some food for thought. And I think in that respect, you have succeeded. Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that.
Oh, good. I'm sure she's around now. You know, it's her birthday, and she's probably around wishing you the best for this interview.
And where can folks find you in the social medias, as they say?
Well, I'm on Facebook, Jim McCarty. There's another Jim McCarty, you know, the guitar player from Cactus, in Detroit. So you got to make sure it's me. But I'm on Facebook. I'm on the James. I think it's jamesmccarty.com is my website, and theyarbirds.com is the official Yarbirds website. And but there's Facebook groups. There's a few Yarbirds authorized and various Yarbirds Facebook groups as well. So you can find out what's going on if you go into the Yarbirds.
Fabulous. Okay. Well, I can see that I know it's late for you because you do live in France now. We didn't really talk about that. But I can see it's getting dark over there. Like it used to be much brighter image that I was talking to, and now it's much darker. But at the same time, my camera's not working, so you don't see anything at all.
Yeah, it's 25 past 9 here now.
So I want to thank you so much for taking the time with me. This was fantastic.
Right. Good.
Is there anything else that you want to share with us that you haven't had an opportunity to?
Well, I don't think so. It's just that I feel, you know, I'm very happy with my life, even though I've been through a few things, you know, particularly the last couple of years. But it's taught me a lot, and there's always more to learn. And I did a song, actually, a solo song called Charmed, which you can see if you look up Jim McCarty Charmed. It's on YouTube. There's a quite a funny video. But that's the way I feel about my life. I do feel charmed. I feel there is somebody looking after me, which is a nice feeling. I'm very grateful for my life and all the people that have helped me.
How about that? His book is called She Walks in Beauty, My Quest for the Bigger Picture, and you can get it through your local bookseller or through Amazon, all the usual suspects there. Definitely worth picking up. Jim McCarty is embarking on a Yardbirds North American tour starting in Cape Cod in mid-September, and as it turns out, finishing at the Ram's Head in Annapolis, Maryland. And then early in 2023, he'll be part of the Flower Power Cruise, which is already sold out, but there is a wait list available. You can get more information on all of this at jamesmccarty.com or at theyardbirds.com. The Sarcoma Foundation of America can be found at www.curesarcoma.org. They have clinics in 37 states across the country, plus they're deeply involved in research and clinical trials. And that, my friend, is a full lid on another edition of How Good It Is. Thanks once again to Jim McCarty for his time and his effort, and to Ann Layton for helping me to put the whole thing together. If you're enjoying the show, please take the time to share it with someone and maybe even leave a rating, or better yet, a review somewhere. And now you can support the show over at patreon.com/howgooditis. If you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at howgoodpodcast@gmail.com, or you can follow the show on Twitter or Instagram at howgooditis. You can also visit, like, and follow the show's Facebook page at facebook.com/howgooditispod. Or you can check out the show's website, howgooditis.com, where you will find a few extra bits. Thank you so much for listening. I'll talk to you next time. How good